will. We've been working our way through several themes, intertwining themes related to the forces of our age. We've already covered Revelation as the source and origin of creative energies. We've seen how the writings describe that the coming of the manifestations not only endows mankind with a new revelation in the sense of a written book of guidance and counsels, but accompanying that written book and that guidance is a tremendous outburst of divine power, divine might, divine energy. And that energy is not simply a force, a mindless force, but it's a configured force. It has within it, latent within it, immense potentialities and possibilities of a higher nature. In fact, with these appearance of these forces, the powers of the higher kingdom are mixed and intertwined with the forces of this lower realm. We've considered a bit how the revelation is experienced by the manifestation of God, this tremendous impact of God revealing through one of these especially chosen representatives this tremendous power of his cause. And we're considering now the impact that then these creative energies have on human society, on the collective affairs of mankind. We know that they can affect individual salvation, redemption on an individual scale, but it's the grand redemptive scheme that Baha'u'llah addresses and which is emphasized in the faith more than the question of individual regeneration and salvation. That's an important element, but it's the manner in which the revelation addresses the human race and the way the human race now responds in bringing about this unity and oneness which Baha'u'llah has promised, which is the goal of the Baha'i Faith. The goal of the Baha'i Faith is not to save individuals per se, but to bring about a change in the condition of mankind which will allow for the development and spiritual growth of individuals. Now you'll recall we ended last week with a consideration of this quotation. As the days roll by, as the perturbations of an imperiled civilization are more alarmingly manifested, the potentialities of God's creative plan correspondingly unfold, and the valor and heroism of its intrepid supporters are more widely and convincingly demonstrated. Now, back in 1931, Shoghi Effendi opened a vision to us. He asks the Baha'is in one of his World Order letters, he says, might it not happen that out of this world eruption there may stream forces of such spiritual energy as shall recall, nay eclipse, the splendor of those signs and wonders that accompanied the establishment of the faith of Jesus Christ? Might there not emerge out of the agony of a shaken world a religious revival of such scope and power as to even transcend the potency of those world-directing forces with which the religions of the past have, at fixed intervals and according to an inscrutable wisdom, revived the fortunes of declining ages and peoples? In both cases, this is he refers to eruption, and then he refers to emerge out of the agony of a shaken world, a religious revival. The history of the development and the influence of enduring past dispensations, the pattern of it is revealed just in that paragraph alone. What has happened when a manifestation appears, what takes place, what the result of it is, how the pattern of it is. He says, so he illustrates, he gives the illustration of the pattern. He says, might this not now repeat itself in this time? It's in World Order of Baha'u'llah, page 33, that particular quotation. Then in a message concerning the House of Baha'u'llah in Baghdad and the concern that the Guardian had for that in 1929, he quotes from Baha'u'llah's tablets about the house. You can look up the exact words that he's quoted. They're found on page 165 of Baha'i Administration. But he reveals something else about this. He says, the direction which the forces released by these prophetic utterances of Baha'u'llah 60 years ago are destined to take in the eventual solution of this mighty issue. And he goes on to talk about it some more. The point is that prophetic utterances revealed by Baha'u'llah release forces that are destined eventually to take effect in solving problems, in creating new situations. This is the whole idea of the way we're examining this question, of the way forces work. They go out and they create a new condition. To the American believers, he wrote in 1940, the disruptive forces associated with humanity's world-shaking ordeal, remember this is now the World War, first, the Second World War has started, the disruptive forces associated with humanity's world-shaking ordeal are closely interrelated with the constructive potentialities inherent in the American believer's divinely ordained plan. We see this close linking the Guardian demonstrates for us, calls our attention to, if you will. On the one hand, disruptive forces. Then he says, these are interrelated with the potentialities inherent in the divine plan. Then he says, both are directly hastening the emergence of a spiritual world order, stirring in the womb of a travailing age. Now, there are going to be a number of other quotations that relate these two things together too. And what we have here, without it being called that, it seems to me, is the major plan of God and the minor plan of God, which Yogi Effendi explains in other messages, that this major and minor plans of God. One, the major plan of God is, Baha'u'llah is the author of both plans, and he directs their operations. But the one takes place in a chaotic, unorganized, unforeseeable manner in the theater of the world on a global scale. And we can't really decipher what's going on. I mean, we know the general direction. We take hope from the fact that through it, mankind is going to be prepared, is going to develop a receptivity of a character that it doesn't have at the present time. And then the minor plan of God, which he says, contrary to this other chaotic and unpredictable, is steady, organized, systematic in its development. And that's the minor plan, is the divine plan of Abdu'l-Bahá. It's given to us to teach the faith and reinforced and partnered together with the paragraphs in the will and testament of Abdu'l-Bahá that call on all the believers of the world to arise and teach the cause of God. These two things work together to create a mandate, if you will, for teaching and spreading the cause of God on the part of those that recognize Baha'u'llah all over the planet. Major plan of God, minor plan of God. There's a whole lot of ideas here already. Maybe someone wants to comment on them or ask something about them. Do you have something you'd like to say? Are you saying, no, I don't want to mention that? Or are you saying, I wish I could think of something, but I can't. Please.
This reference showing Effendi to a possible religious revival following future calamities. Does that necessarily mean that it must be the Baha'i faith initially, or could we see a big revival of the existing world religion, first of all?
Mm-hmm. It doesn't specify, but it could be. We noticed that in the process of the people, for instance, in the East, coming out of the difficulties that they've suffered all this time, they're reaching for religion of all sorts. And in a sense, they'll experience disappointment with the older dispensations because they don't have the same capacity, obviously, that the revelation in this day has to address their needs. But they may work their way through a quick progressive revelation pattern to find out where the faith is. It's interesting how receptive the people of Albania are. We were just hearing more news. They're coming in, more and more believers, now 80 believers in Tirana. And two other large groups in the country, in secondary cities. And they had a public meeting there just recently. I think this 125 people came to the first public meeting. And this included lawyers and professional people, professors in the university. 35 out of the 120 became Baha'is that night. So that gives you some idea of the receptivity of people. The country is 60% Muslim. But, of course, the teaching and understanding of religion has been suppressed for decades, so the Muslims are not really very well educated in the faith, but they want to hear that you believe in the Quran. And it's wonderful to be able to, for the first time in a Western teaching situation, to say, we believe in the Quran. Oh, good. But this is at the same time, they're also interested in the other faiths that are moving around. It just depends who gets there first. They will come to the cause, we know eventually, but it would be easier if we were able to get there and lay a foundation for the faith and give them a chance to choose. At least they know about it, you know. They can choose.
We know that there's going to be mass opposition to the faith from all the world religions. So in a way, does that not imply that their influence increases, at least, you know, temporarily?
Their influence increases? No, I think it's on the wane, but it's just so much. It's so powerful still that, you know, if the Catholic Church addresses itself to you, you'll feel it. I don't think it's going to get greater. It may flame up in contrast, you know, as it opposes the cause. But we're not going to have massive worldwide opposition to the faith until we have massive worldwide recognition of the faith. You know, it's going to take a large-scale attraction and enrollment of believers. Otherwise, they can take care of us with a few words locally and they don't get it into the international sphere, you know. But if we have a country where, I mean, a country everybody knows the name of and has been interested in its history, even some place like Albania where you have maybe 10, 15, 20% of the population if they come to the cause, that would create a stir in the world that we don't know about yet. We can't quite understand what the implications of that would be. Now, so far in Albania, we don't have any pioneers. They have a local assembly made up of all local people. They're working for the recognition of the faith. There's a new bill in parliament about freedom of religion in the country. Freedom of religion in the country means all the other religions are going to come, all the other sects and everything are going to come with all their money and all their... So we're working as fast as we can. We've got Baha'is there now. They keep going in small tour groups of 15, one after the other. And the tour guides say, what are you people? We arranged to take you to the beach and to the castle and you won't come to the tour. And they're cooking other things. A quotation later on from a World Order letter here. Shoghi Effendi says, "The whole of mankind is groaning, is dying to be led to unity and to terminate its age-long martyrdom." Now here he's voiced the feelings of the whole of mankind, for she knows from Baha'u'llah's writings what they are. "And yet," he says, "it stubbornly refuses to embrace the light and acknowledge the sovereign authority of the one power that can extricate it from the entanglements and avert the woeful calamity that threatens to engulf it." Notice how instead of saying the one faith here, he says the one power with a capital P. We need to think of the faith as a power, you know, along with thinking of it as a religion. We need to think of the faith as a world order, a whole system for the governance and maintenance of order and peace and unity on the planet, rather than as a religion. In a sense, Shoghi Effendi said to pilgrims back in the 1930s that to call the Baha'i faith a religion was a disservice because of the idea people have about religion. They think, oh, the Baha'i faith is a religion. What they know about religion is a Sunday school religion, you know, it's a kind of a thing that you do on Sundays and you read. When you're feeling bad, you read it and it's uplifting and it's lovely words and we like it. And I believe in it. It's good. There's nothing wrong with it, you know. That kind of religion. Whereas he says, this is the world order of Baha'u'llah, creates another impression. Now it's early and you have to be on your guard where you use such a term. But in the East, they understand it in those terms. And now with all the new world order that we've got coming out of governments and peoples all over the thing, they talk about a new world order. We talk about the new world order of Baha'u'llah. You know, is this something, this specific kind of world order that has its whole program already established? Don't have to grope around and try to find out what it is. Now, the only way they'll be successful is adopting aspects of Baha'u'llah's world order. Then whenever they get into that line, then they're assisted, because divine power accelerates anything that conforms to the divine purpose. So you and I conform to it, we're accelerated, moved along. Some social innovation conforms to it, it gets accelerated and moved along, and energized in strange ways that people don't know why. You know? That's World Order, page 201, that last quotation. Then again in 1940 to the Friends in America, he wrote, this is a very revealing quotation here too. Excuse me. "As the administrative processes expand, as their operation steadily improves, as their necessity is more fully and strikingly demonstrated, and their beneficent influence correspondingly grows more apparent and evident, so will the blessings, the strength, and guidance bestowed by him who animates and directs these processes be more abundantly vouchsafed to those who have been called upon to utilize them in this age for the execution of God's purpose and for the ultimate redemption of a sore-stricken, travailing humanity." What a sentence. One sentence. There's so many things important here. He says that, first of all, the identification of administrative processes. We'll find some other links here between how the creative energies, the power and force released by Baha'u'llah, translates itself into creative energies. These creative energies become manifest in processes. These processes are called by Shoghi Effendi here administrative processes, or the processes of the administrative order. This is not meaning just administrative matters, but the administration of all of the intent and purpose of the cause of God. One of the processes of the administrative order is the question of individual conversion. Another process of the administrative order is the reinforcement and strengthening of the key supporters of the faith, of people who can become vital supporters and not just acknowledge the truth of the faith, but arise and in some way support it and develop it. Another process of the administrative order is the election of local spiritual assemblies. Another process is the translation and distribution of the holy words of God, of the divine texts in different languages. Another process is the recognition of by holy days, the establishment of the incorporated local and national assemblies. Another process is the proclamation of the cause. Another process now is the initiation of social and economic development programs. These are all processes of the administrative order. And if you examine Shoghi Effendi's message, you find him referring to them by this name, as processes. Also, he identifies them in different places. The process of the development of literature frame. This is something you can find in the text, examine in the text, and make a list of. So the world order of Baha'u'llah, the embryonic world order of Baha'u'llah, which is the world administrative order of the present hour, manifests its development along lines of process lines. And each one's working, interrelated, they have a dynamic influence one on the other, and the cause of God moves forward. And the divine plan is the spirit animating these processes, and the Holy Spirit is the spirit animating the divine plan, and so it all moves down the line. We see what's happening, we see its development. Then he says it's, instead of saying, okay, it's the House of Justice or the Guardian or the National Assemblies who animate and direct these processes, he doesn't say that. He says, capital Him who. Baha'u'llah is the source of this. He's the one that's causing these processes to operate. It's He who has released this energy. It's He who is directing its development in channels and ways that we can't estimate. We shouldn't think of ourselves as separate from His the outreach of His wings, of His presence, of His dynamic impression on everything that's going on. And Shoghi Effendi refers in the message also to his supreme commander, you know, to Abdul Baha, who's directing the forces of light and the army of light. So you have to think of these holy figures looking down on everything that's being done. And Shoghi Effendi often in his messages says that the central figures of the faith, beholding your actions from on high, applaud your efforts and rejoice in the kingdom at your services. Now, this is also affirmed in different talks of Abdul Baha. We cannot see the other world. We generally don't see the other world. Sometimes we might have a peek or a sniff. As he says, a divine fragrance reaches us and we're moved and stirred by it. Well, that's possible, but not always, not at your beck and call anyway. But from the other side, he says that the souls observe us and can perceive the friends, and particularly are interested in their loved ones, in those that they love and care about and know, in those that are serving the cause, in those that are performing deeds in the path of God. These are the object of their interest and of their prayers and of their hopes. And he says that from that side they perceive us in terms of the state of our souls. That's how they tell how we're doing, you know. Like Baha'u'llah says, in that day you will be judged by your brows. You know, it will be written on your brow, whatever you are. It will be clear enough to see. And he says, when the soul is in a state of attraction and is radiating, the souls in the other kingdom rejoice. Because they see that soul is in the image and likeness of its maker, and it's shining with the lights and qualities of the names and attributes of God that constitute the very foundation of creation. But if, on the other hand, it sees a soul enshrouded in mists and surrounded by clouds, then it prays, they pray for that soul, that it could be released from this oppression, so that it could become a fresh fountain of crystal light and amidst the peoples of the world and amidst the friends. We don't see it. They see it. They see the operation of these forces. we need to witness the effect. We witness the effects of unseen things, invisible developments, in outward manifestations. And so we see the progress of the cause, we see the exhilaration of the friends, we know there's spirit there, we know that thing is going forward, we see the growth, we see the influence of it. It's like you can't really see the wind, but you see the influence of the wind, because all the leaves on the tree are shimmering and moving in the sunlight when the breeze blows through. There are certain things that we know by their effects in this world. Well, this is one of them, the effect and influence of Divine Spirit. I'll read that sentence again, then we'll go on. There's a few more sentences in that same passage. Or one more. As the administrative processes expand, this is a tremendous promise too. He's telling us that what's happening here is that as we go forward and this thing becomes more complex, we're going to have greater outpourings of blessings and bounties and guidance. It's part of the potential. As there are more Baha'is, as there are more institutions, then the whole operation of these forces becomes clearer and more dynamic. As the administrative processes expand, as their operation steadily improves, it's another thing we all say. From time to time we complain that the administration doesn't work the way it is. Getting too bureaucratic. It has its way of curing itself. It hurts us a little in the process because we're usually the ones that are making it bureaucratic. So we get pinched and pulled and twisted until we wake up and say, there's a better way to do this, you know. As their operation steadily improves, as their necessity is more fully and strikingly demonstrated, and their beneficent influence correspondingly grows more apparent and evident, so will the blessings, the strength, and guidance bestowed by him who animates and directs these processes be more abundantly vouchsafed to those who have been called upon to utilize them in this age for the execution of God's purpose and for the ultimate redemption of a sore, stricken, travailing humanity. Many will be the setbacks, the shocks, and the disturbances which the commotions of a convulsive age must produce. Yet no force, however violent, and worldwide in its range and catastrophic in its immediate consequences, can either halt these processes or deflect their appointed course. This is, you know, this is salve for the soul in these times that we're living in. It doesn't matter what happens. These processes are God's way of establishing his kingdom, and they're going to move forward. They can be deflected, they can be interrupted, they can be setbacks, but they're going to go forward. Ultimately, along the course appointed for them, a fixed course appointed for them. Sometimes by our own unwisdom, we can slow down some of these processes. Some of them speed up. But deflected off its course, no. You can get deflected off the course, but the process is not going to get deflected off the course. You can go over here and pine and lament and complain how the Baha'is treat you and what this happened and how that happened and God isn't good to me and I don't know what all, and become isolated and paralyzed and useless. That's possible. But also you can find your way back to the mainstream of this pointed course and get in it again, and you'll find yourself swept forward. That's 15th of May, 1940, that particular. It's one of the key paragraphs in this consideration. Messages to America, pages 41 and 42. Now there's a quote here from The Advent of Divine Justice, page 86. This is referring to the, again, that was addressed to the American believers, and it has reference to the American nation. It refers to a nation there. In that case, it's the United States. He says, Shoghi Effendi says, for no matter how ignorant of the source, capital S, from which those directing energies proceed, and however slow and laborious the process, it is becoming increasingly evident that the nation as a whole, whether through the agency of its government or otherwise, is gravitating under the influence of forces that it can neither comprehend nor control, towards such associations and policies wherein, as indicated by Abdu'l-Bahá, her true destiny must lie. Both the community of the American believers who are aware of that source and the great mass of their countrymen who have not as yet recognized the hand that directs their destiny are contributing each in its own way to the realization of the hopes and the fulfillment of the promises voiced in the above quoted words of Abdu'l-Bahá. This is about the destiny of America and the role that they have to play. Now, this is the process described at the national level in America, which is probably the key process of this sort. But wherever Baha'u'llah has pronounced on the spiritual destiny of a people or of a particular nation or of a particular continent, these same forces are operating. They're gradually, the Baha'is, aware of the source of that confirmation, that promise, that intended destiny, are linked together with the peoples and their governments and other agencies who, unbeknownst to themselves, are beginning to align themselves to the destiny that's been established for them by the holy texts. It magnetizes them, it attracts them in some mysterious, invisible manner, and you see them beginning to play their role. You can see this the example of the moment is how Italy has arisen to assist in the spiritual development of Albania. Germany has itself its hands full. It's been assigned Albania, but it's asked to have Italy collaborate. Italy's asked if it could collaborate. And now there's a tremendous passing of authority from the German NSA to the Italian NSA. Go ahead now. Publish literature, go teach, organize it, and get it running, you know, because Germany's faced with the development, for example, of Poland. It needs to take care of now, in the meanwhile. Another very interesting passage, and this is a later one, 1947. Shoghi Effendi writes, as the international situation worsens, as the fortunes of mankind sink to a still lower ebb, and the momentum of the plan... Sorry. There's no and. Let me read it again. As the international situation worsens, as the fortunes of mankind sink to still lower ebb, the momentum of the plan must be further accelerated. Mankind sinks, the Baha'is have to try harder. They have to move. They work faster. And the concerted exertions of the community responsible for its execution rise to still higher levels of consecration and heroism. So we see, as the shades of night descend, the Baha'is have to assume their destined role in the reorientation of society. And they will be vouchsafed the assistance they need to match the darkness with corresponding light. As the fabric of present-day society heaves and cracks under the strain and stress of portentous events and calamities, as the fissures accentuating the cleavage separating nation from nation, class from class, race from race, and creed from creed multiply, the prosecutors of the plan must evince a still greater cohesion in their spiritual lives and administrative activities and demonstrate a higher standard of concerted effort, of mutual assistance, and of harmonious development in their collective enterprises. How much more that should be reflected here in the friends serving at the World Center. What a model of these qualities we should become. Then and only then will the reaction to the stupendous forces released through the operation of a divinely conceived, divinely impelled plan be made apparent. That is when the Baha'is evince a still greater cohesion in their spiritual lives and administrative activities, demonstrate a higher standard in their effort and of mutual assistance, harmonious development. Page 43 of Civil Faith. The impact of creative energies on human society, this is what this is we've been referring to. The fourth section of the study refers to revelation as the source of universal ferment. Now we've heard this hinted at in some of the other passages. There's some repetition here. It brings back, it focuses from this angle. You know, you can look at this whole question, this whole pattern or development from different aspects. And these are a few of the facets of the whole truth that we're trying to see about operation of divine forces. Now, do you have any thoughts that you'd like to say or questions? Or please.
What do you think a lot of catastrophes seem to happen to poor areas and poor people?
Such as Ethiopia. Yes. Of course, this is part of it is human administration, bad human administration, you know, where you're saying having people starving to death and the crops haven't been developed and there's been no provision of water in areas where they needed it to be able to produce agricultural products. So it's part of it is a result of human misadministration, which has to teach us something along those lines. But sometimes there's other things besides drought. Now, some of the drought's been produced also by ecological disasters that have been the result of human actions, too. Sometimes there's typhoons. I'm sure I don't know how these things operate. It's mysterious, but there must be laws connected with it. There must be something connected with it. At the same time, Baha'u'llah says, my calamity is my providence. So sometimes, you know, these things can... I mean, if you think of the Eastern countries, how oppressed they were for decades. You can't imagine what is the meaning of it for a person that's gone into that. It was a 40-year-long nightmare, so to speak, and they died after 30 years. And you say, well, where's the justice in this? But God is able to recompense all matter of inequity. And if He is the just, He's going to have to recompense it in some manner, you know. It's according to His own promises and laws. So the things we suffer here, ultimately we see them as suffering, but perhaps the souls, after they have reaped the reward of their human existence, see it as an advantage. Adubat talks about the special blessings connected with soldiers who die in battle. I mean, have no cause of their own, you know. They're caught up in something like this. And their lives are snuffed out. And he said there's all kinds of laws related to it. He says this in some answered questions. Or of infants that die at birth or of illnesses in early childhood. But it's mysterious to be able to fully answer the question. Not even the scriptures answer it. They give some hints, but they don't give full answers. I suppose if the housing wasn't so good in England, when they'd have one of these really freezing blizzards there, you know, everybody would die too. I mean, lots of people would suffer. It's already very dangerous as it is. some of the areas of the world, things are developed to a degree where the people are more protected. And then last week, I think we were talking a little bit about the interaction of people's moral qualities and outward manifestations, the environment itself, what kind of interactions there might be there. There's some hints in the writings to that, but it's mysterious too. And someone back here had a question. Ivan, was it you on it?
It seemed like the all the pioneers that traveled around the Pacific had a good grip on where the faith was heading and the goals of the faith and everything. So, as you say, when faith starts to slow down, we need to like swim harder. But it seems like at the present time there's so much going on and we're not all sort of in the flow of it and we don't sort of have a real grip of what's going on. So it's when the house just puts out a message, it's kind of hard to react to it because you can't put it into context, into a picture to see where it's all heading.
Whereas that's probably, except for some little news items, that's going to give you an indication of where it is heading and why it's heading there. You know, the house has to kind of condense and interpret the events so that we will understand more what is going on. And in a sense, it broadens our vision and our horizon, though we may not know the details of the individual parts of it. Of a trend or of some tremendous development. They give us enough highlights to get something of the flavor. If you want to know more, you have to go out and get in the campaigns and be on the front lines. This 2-year plan, there's never been anything like it in the cause, neither in its scope nor in the audacity of its goals nor in the rapidity of their accomplishment. Or in the number of souls embracing the cause in a single period under the aegis of a plan like that. It's amazing. It isn't finished yet. You know, we're kind of thundering down the last months, building up national assemblies out of nothing, just suddenly starting to spring up the possibilities of having national assemblies in Bulgaria and Albania and Hungary and Poland and Yugoslavia. It's there, there's a possibility there.
Speaking of the Atlantic stuff, came back national convention in Romania, talking about buses and missing buses on a normal ice, keep missing the buses. Now, this is one more bus. That we should catch, and if we don't, it's going to be another big loss for the community. Maybe you could relate what she was saying about buses to this course that offered. Now that God sort of gives us a hand to do something, then we should take that opportunity to use that.
A poll. Will the people in this room who are planning to go to Romania in the future raise their hands? pretty good percentage. Oh, good. This side of the room has got somebody. I don't know. And how many World Center people do we have in those countries right now taking part in the campaigns? I think Roy Ajun's coming back tomorrow on a pilgrimage. We'll hear something what's happening in Bulgaria and some of the other places. It's great. I think that's the best way to relate it. I mean, you know, it's become a suggestion and an urging. It's wonderful to go to Rome. The other countries need help too. Maybe if Rhea Kanum had gone to more than one country, she would have had more to say on the subject. But she went to Romania, she could surely see the need there. And she has stressed it. Now we see that the receptivity, the Romanians that have gone to Bulgaria say that Bulgaria is equally or more receptive than Romania. And the counselors say Albania outstrips them both. It's just, can't compare it. So is this what you want to talk about? Please, Eamon.
Just on that subject, is anything happening at all in North Korea?
Not very much. Some Baha'is have gone in and out, but they've still, you know, they're still kind of hermetically sealed. It's not. Some Baha'is are doing business, which is one way of getting in and out. They're doing business through Beijing with firms and things in North Korea. And one of the South American countries, a number of North Koreans became interested in the faith because of programs to take care of their youth who were in school there on the part of Baha'is. They were nervous, but they were also pleased with the result of the influence of the faith on the young people. I mean, there are, you know, there's a certain sincerity in this, some areas of this thing. It has its facets of brutality and limitations, but there's also, there's a kind of idealism in some quarters to produce something new and good. And I think this is what's now making the people so receptive. You know, they've been told there's a system and there's got to be some way to have this equity and justice on, and then they found that the system they have doesn't work. So they're looking for something else to do that particular job. And maybe it's for that reason that they conceive the faith in such a broader sense than normally we do in Western countries. Yes?
How is their relationship with the government?
The Baha'is relationship?
Yeah.
No, it hasn't. But with individual and important and prominent Chinese, the faith is moving ahead. And many of them are making private enrollments outside of China and going back to China. But it has to all be very discreet in the sense that, you know, this is still, it's still, there's not enough known about the faith and what it's doing, I think, in the highest quarters to, there's still an interest in retaining the whole machinery of communism there. So one has to wait and see what's going to happen. It's not easy to move ahead too quickly, and it doesn't seem to be the wisdom of the moment.
The attitude of some other religions in that country is kind of different. They are more aggressive. They seem to have a more aggressive attitude. And I mean, the faith is taking a more cautious attitude. And, I mean, there is wisdom in it, but in some ways, we feel like it's like we're missing a bus again. I mean, when I was there a few months ago, I talked to some of the Baha'is and they were talking about these Christians that were campaigning, going all over and gathering and having meetings regularly and bringing a lot of people, you know, into their meetings and openly teaching their faith on the street, whereas we were kind of very cautious and not talking, just making friends.
The House of Justice stated clearly in a message just recently that it's not going to be published broadly, but it's to the National Assembly's concern, that now is the time for a vast number of settlers and pioneers to go to mainland China and settle in natural ways in jobs and professions and services that they can do there, and to quietly teach the faith. But also, you know, we have other information that it doesn't spread around, that people disappear, they still disappear there. So there's something to be said for the safety of the people you're teaching. You know, you can be reckless and say, okay, we want the faith to go forward and we'll have a few martyrs and then never mind. But is that our choice? I mean, we also know of constraints and of where the Baha'is have been called in and checked by authorities. You know, there are. You can feel the limitations if you look at the whole picture and you hear all the reports from every area. You can see that we're doing in some areas we're doing about as much as we can. In some areas we have to pull back a little bit from the influence that.
Maybe in some ways also. Sorry, I'm taking a
comment. No, it's a good subject.
It seems that the effect of other religions when actually Chinese who were Christians and became Baha'i are much stronger, and maybe it's a natural process that they're going through, and maybe really Christians are really helping the faith in some ways, introducing the concept of God into this society.
Yes. It may well be part of a process too. I mean, everything is working towards the ends of the faith in one way or another. You know, comes out that way. In Latin America, I remember areas where Baha'is wanted to go and teach in Catholic villages, they couldn't. They would go there and they would start teaching the faith and saying, what we need is unity. They said, we have unity. What are you doing coming and destroying it? I'll throw rocks at you. So you went again, you left. So then the Christians went in there, the evangelists, you know, and they started in. And they got stoned and they got beaten up and their houses burned down. But they got believers. Because they stayed and they insisted. When the Baha'is go back now, they say, now the disunity that exists in Christianity, we have to do something about it. So there's something about, in fact, we notice also Baha'is that come from an evangelist background in Latin America are much stronger as Baha'is generally than the Catholics are. Whereas in the United States, you find oftentimes Baha'is of Catholic background are stronger than people of Protestant background when they come into the faith. Because they're a minority and they've had to struggle to keep their religious identity, you know, against the majority that opposes them. Or has a prejudice against them in any case. The result of that is that you get, like you say, fibers are strengthened. And maybe that's the way it'll be. We'll have to see. I'm certainly not a wizard on the question of China, but something is going to have to happen to open the way for the faith there. But there are a number of forces working and conferences being planned and collaborations with Ministry of Education on moral education in the country. There are things that are happening that are not announced a whole lot, you know, that are going on at high levels. And people are learning. And important Chinese outsider learning things about it, and they will be able to help solve this problem, which is mainly one of not wanting any additional doctrine coming into China, you know, not letting anything non-Chinese into China to influence the Chinese. There's a certain core of that policy that's there. That's the one. We don't want to offend too seriously. But at the same time, we have to go ahead. So we'll see what happens now. Maybe we'll get more settlers, more workers, and in a natural way can bring the cause to the attention of the Chinese. And
maybe, in fact, that the entire world is in such a place, and they're now negotiating to have Taiwan back again, wouldn't they? So maybe we'll be behind in Taiwan.
Maybe, yeah. Although Hong Kong, the Baha'is of Hong Kong are scheduled for conferences. incorporation in the PRC too. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. This is the fourth part of this. Collection of quotations of Shoghi Effendi. Revelation as a source of universal ferment. Everybody knows what a ferment is? Like a fermentation, like something boiling and bubbling and developing. From Persia, the cradle of our faith and the object of our tenderest affections, there breaks upon us the news of the first stirrings of that social and political reformation, this is 1928, which, as we firmly believe, is but the direct and unavoidable consequence of that great spiritual revival ushered in by the revelation of Baha'u'llah. These social and political forces now released by the source of such a tremendous revival are bound in their turn to demolish one by one the barriers that have so long impeded its flow, sapped its vitality, and obscured its radiance. That's referring to what the effects of this revival, from the source of this revival, in the form of social and political forces now released in Persia, is producing. And of course, there's a whole long process of this thing going on. What does it tell us? I mean, can we extrapolate from this the principle that social and political forces in the world also derive their energy from the source of the revelation and the revival of the fortunes of humankind? Source is capitalized here. And it gives us some idea, you know. If we think that the cause of God is a small, insignificant cause that's adrift on the sea of tremendous chaotic conditions and things in the world, and we think in despair, how will the cause ever overcome all of this nightmare around us and all these depressing things and all this? How can we, this little cause of ours, ever go forward, you know? It just looks impossible to us. That's if we look with our eyes. Now, if we look with Shoghi Effendi's eyes, he tells us all of the social and political forces released in the world, agitating the masses, it's all a result of this divine energy that's come from Baha'u'llah. And it's destined to tear down, barrier by barrier, those things which impede the fulfillment of his purpose for mankind. Then we get a lot more hopeful, because we got a lot of evidences, a lot of proofs to back this up. All you have to do is open the newspaper and you can see the proofs of the faith, the proofs of the influence of the revelation. Now, you might not sell that to a non-Baha'i, but Shoghi Effendi is giving us a way to understand and interpret this ourselves, so that we don't despair when we see difficulties in the world, eruptions of tremendous force, convulsions on all sides. All these things he's telling us about. That was back in 1928. In 1932, he said, "The religious crisis through which we are now passing, besides being unprecedented in its intensity, is being coupled with economic conditions of the most distressing character. Human society is today attacked by both spiritual and material forces. And under the pressure of these combined powers, the very basis of our social life is being gradually undermined," of this old social life. Did you follow that? The implications of that? Please.
When I hear this passage, I thought of something about the natural process of growth, of a shoot and decay of a all three. And it seems that the description that Shoghi Effendi is giving us here is that decay of that all three. And the decay is contributing to the nourishment of that little shoot that is coming out of the soil.
Yes, all of these elements that have broken down and return in a chaotic way provide the source bed from which then the new order of things. The same elements have to form the world order that formed the old order. I mean, it's you're picking elements off and reordering them, reconfiguring them, so to speak, aren't you, in a new order of things. Removing them from patterns that now don't work anymore. Except we don't have to remove them, they come apart by themselves and then find their way to us. Oh, it's a long passage from the World Order. Maybe we'll finish with this one. This is page 170 of World Order Letters. As we view the world around us, we are compelled to observe the manifold evidences of that universal fermentation which in every continent of the globe and in every department of human life, be it religious, social, economic, or political, is purging and reshaping humanity in anticipation of the day when the wholeness of the human race will have been recognized and its unity established. So we're compelled to observe the evidences of this fermentation in all walks of life. A twofold process, however, can be distinguished, each tending in its own way and with an accelerated momentum to bring to a climax the forces that are transforming the face of our planet. The first is essentially an integrating process, while the second is fundamentally disruptive. The former, as it steadily evolves, unfolds a system which may well serve as a pattern for that world polity towards which a strangely disordered world is continually advancing. While the latter, as its disintegrating influence deepens, tends to tear down with increasing violence the antiquated barriers that seek to block humanity's progress towards its destined goal. The constructive process stands associated with the nascent faith of Baha'u'llah and is the harbinger of the New World Order that that faith must ere long establish. The destructive forces that characterizes the other should be identified with a civilization that has refused to answer to the expectation of a new age and is consequently falling into chaos and decline. These forces were not meant to operate in that way, but when they meet opposition, that's the effect. In other words, if the elements of life and the elements of society conform and resonate to the divine revelation, there wouldn't be any destruction. But when they resist the patterns and oppose it, that leads to the downfall and disintegration of those agencies or institutions or attitudes or whatever it might be. Now he talks to us about a struggle, a spiritual struggle. He says, a spiritual struggle, unparalleled in its magnitude, yet unspeakably glorious in its ultimate consequences, is being waged as a result of these opposing tendencies. In this age of transition, through which the organized community of the followers of Baha'u'llah and mankind as a whole are passing, titanic spiritual struggle. And he goes on in the final paragraph of this passage and he says, the spirit, capital S, the spirit that has incarnated itself in the institutions of a rising faith, the Spirit that has incarnated itself into the institutions of a rising faith has, in the course of its onward march for the redemption of the world, encountered and is now battling with such forces as are in most instances the very negation of that Spirit, and whose continued existence must inevitably hinder it from achieving its purpose. Now here, these forces are the forces of darkness that we're going to study about more, and we're going to get lists of them from Shoghi Effendi's writings. He's given the names of them. And you can imagine ahead of time, we're not talking about occult forces, we're talking about potent social forces, we're talking about human prejudice, we're talking about hatred, we're talking about fanaticism, we're talking about materialism, we're talking about atheism. These are the forces of darkness that he says can invade our souls too if we're not careful. The hollow and outworn institutions, the obsolescent doctrines and beliefs, the effete and discredited traditions which these forces represent, it should be observed, have in certain instances been undermined by virtue of their senility, the loss of their cohesive power, and their own inherent corruption. Now he's talking about institutions, doctrines, beliefs, traditions, which these forces represent. He's talking about what's happened to some of them. They have become undermined by virtue of their own senility, or the loss of their cohesive power, and their own inherent corruption. He goes on to say, a few have been swept away by the onrushing forces which the Baha'i faith has at the hour of its birth so mysteriously released. Others, as a direct result of a vain and feeble resistance to its rise in the initial stages of its development, have died out and been utterly discredited. Still others, fearful of the pervasive influence of the institutions in which that same spirit had at a later stage been embodied, had mobilized their forces and launched their attack, destined to sustain in their turn, after a brief and illusory success, an ignominious defeat. Now, Shoghi Effendi always talks about these movements and things that attack the cause. Part of the crisis is that there is this illusory effect of their achieving their purpose. Think of the suffering we had as we stood by helplessly watching this diabolical machine in the cradle of the faith, grinding up the prime Baha'is in that country. If you can imagine a frustration and suffering for the House of Justice greater than that, I don't know what it would be. We're told by Baha'u'llah to not arise in arms, an armed struggle against those that persecute us, to submit to it, to go to martyrdom in the right spirit. But at the same time, the institutions of the faith want to take every step they can to not have the believers have to face such situations. And how... you should have been here in the World Center. It was like a valley of tears all the time here. Tuesday morning prayers were an agony. Mr. Fatih Islam would stand up with the latest news by telephone, and he'd stand there and his face would shake and he couldn't speak. And then he'd start reading off the names of martyrs and how many people were killed last night. Blessing. It had such a powerful, sobering effect on the friends here at the World Center and on the Baha'is in the outside world, if they could take it in. Some of the Baha'is wrote and said, please don't send us more news of martyrdom. We joined this faith because it was a happy religion. Not yet able to digest that they belong to a religion for which you could suffer martyrdom. When we teach and talk about this to the friends, we have to not frighten them by telling them that nobody's going to be martyred that doesn't want to be martyred. You know? But Allah doesn't want martyrs that don't want to be martyrs. This, lots of people marched right out of the prison that were in the same circumstances as the one that marched straight to the place of their death. It's mysterious things. You can't understand how it is. And how many of the martyrs wrote these beautiful testimonies of how they'd given themselves to Baha'u'llah and how they knew this was correct and how they greeted the executioners and gave them candies in some cases and told them not to worry that this was in the hands of God and don't worry about this. I don't hold any grief for you that you shoot me. And they got some of these soldiers crying. They didn't know how to respond to such things. This is the kind of news that was coming to us. But then look what has happened since out of that, how the whole cause lifted up in the world. All the governments of the world came to understand this problem. All the governments of the world felt to some degree the frustration the Baha'is were feeling. It transferred to them. And their houses of legislation and their parliaments issued decrees and statements calling upon the Iranian governments to cease and desist from these barbaric acts against the Baha'i community, for which they developed an empathy. Now the cause of God, we know in the first place, progressed through the blood of martyrs. I mean, we're talking about 20,000 people sacrificing their lives so the cause could burst into flame in the world and start to grow. This opposition, the reaction of the opposition, it's mysterious, but it makes the cause grow. Illusory success. After a brief and illusory success, apparent success, which afterwards, that crisis turns into a great victory for the cause. A triumph of the spirit. Now we have a second volume of the Dombrakis to write. We have all the materials for another volume of the Dombrakis. Those are the central figures in it, but what acts of heroism, what amazing deeds were performed in those days. Mysterious events, those were in the cradle of the faith. And in some ways you could look back and you could have said, you never would have imagined that those people were going to arise and give their life. And on the other hand, you could say, you never would have imagined that those people would have hidden and run away from it. A strange shifting and sifting of the Baha'is of Iran took place in it. God indeed acts in mysterious manners and ways. I don't mean to criticize people who escaped in general, but some people were not there at the hour or didn't come back, and others flew back to the country instead of going out of it, you know. We don't know what works in people's souls. We don't know the destiny of all of them, but this is a very mysterious process. Very mysterious process. And with each, the elimination of the heads of the faith there, those that were serving in outstanding capacities, outstanding teachers, the more they were mowed down, the more a next rank came forward and took this thing. So that the NSA of Iran was annihilated one evening. And the next day there was an announcement from the NSA of Iran about it. This had them crazy, you know. How come? Because it was created in such a way that the elections and there were substitute assemblies to step in. As soon as one assembly disappeared, there was another 9 there ready to go, or however many needed to go into them. And they had their secret ways of meeting and so on. All of this stopped because for some unknown reason, the government suddenly passed the decree that the Baha'i faith was illegal. Now, they'd never said that because they never would pronounce the name Baha'i, you know. But they said, this administration, we want you to stop it. And when they heard that the governor, not the attorney general, had said this is illegal and has to stop, the administration's faith has stopped, it stopped the next day. The House announced it's dissolved, finished. Oh, if they'd known that from the beginning, they would have saved themselves some trouble. And then we announced that to the governments of the world, that we'd taken this step because they said it's illegal and we don't go against it. We're not operating illegally. That was an astonishment, another astonishment. Amazing history. Okay, friends. Next week.